I'm going to call to order the Energy Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee meeting for April 19th. And at the end of the meeting on the 17th, we did hear a few of the bills that are for consideration today. And we are continuing those, and starting with a couple of bills by Senator Murphy, Senate File 2081 and 1930. So, Senator Murphy.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. I'd like to start talking about 2081 first, since I believe that that's the bill that is a little more inclusive. 2081 removes the ban on the certificate of need for new nuclear generation in the state of Minnesota. And the reason why I've offered this up is because there's a plethora of electrical generation options that are out there. And unfortunately, in the state of Minnesota, there's a few of these options, nuclear being one of them, that when it comes time to build new base load plants is not considered. And it's not considered for a couple of reasons. One, it's because of the certificate of need. We believe that it's best left up to the professionals over at the Public Utilities Commission on whether or not to grant those. They are far and away the experts in the area. The other thing that the bill does is it asks for the Electric Energy Task Force.
Senator Murphy, I'm going to interrupt you just a minute to let it be known on the record that a quorum has checked in. Thank you.
Thank you. The second part of the bill, which basically starts down on the bottom of page one and continues on to page two, is a nuclear energy study that would be conducted by the Electric Energy Task Force. It goes on page two of the bill. It goes through and lists a few of the things that are asked to be looked at in the study, and kind of do a compare and contrast between nuclear and other means of generating electrical energy, such as coal or coal gasification, and some of the others. And they're all listed on the back page. And not only do we ask that they kind of compare and contrast, but we also set up a parameter by which we can get some pretty concrete and definite information built together so that we can make better decisions in the future. And that's what this is all about. Because of Madam Chairman, because of yourself and Senator Anderson, the state of Minnesota is now moving forward in our renewable energy endeavors. And we're going to place the state of Minnesota by far and away in the lead on any other state towards moving towards alternative forms of energy. It doesn't remove the fact that we are going to, in the future, near future, going to need many thousand more megawatts of electricity to continue to operate our state the way that it has been for many years now. And I don't think that we should do that, in my opinion, once again, with old forms of technology that are polluters. I've said it once, I'll say it a million times. The only stigma against nuclear power is that there is leftover spent nuclear fuel. And, you know, there's not the greenhouse gases that come out of coal plants or even gas plants. There's one energy provider in the state of Minnesota that's taken two of their largest plants in the metropolitan area and have converted them, in the process of converting them from coal to gas. If we continue to do that and rely more and more on one source, that source is going to get more and more expensive. And that's the same gas that we heat our homes with, or, well, the majority of people in Minnesota heat their homes with. I don't think that the general public would appreciate us driving up the price of gas to the point where they have to make a decision between heating their home and buying food. I don't think that that's a good option at all. Nuclear power over the course of the years has proven to be safe, reliable, clean, and I think that we need to study this issue through the Electric Energy Task Force, a task force that Mr. Fuller helped write the legislation for, and I can say that I was proud to be a member of that task force and work with Willard Munger to make sure that the Electric Energy Task Force got kicked off and got started in the right direction. I do believe that the Electric Energy Task Force needs to step to the plate now and start doing some of the yeoman work that needs to happen before we come and start making decisions on whatever type of power it is we're going to use in the state, whether it's nuclear, coal, gas, wind, biomass, whatever it might be. And this report will help the legislature better understand the issues surrounding nuclear energy and the rest of the energy field, I think, in a more comprehensive manner. Madam Chair, that's about it for the first bill. The second bill is Senate file.
Senator Marty, first, are there any questions from committee members on Senate file 2081?
Madam Chair.
Senator Alcine.
Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, if we remove this prohibition of nuclear power plants, I don't suspect Xcel has one on the shelf, a plan for a new plant. Is this the object just, that it's an option that's available in the future?
Senator Murphy.
Yes, Madam Chairman, and Senator Alcine, you're exactly right. You know, it's tough to build anything in the state, whether it's roads or colleges, whatever, if you don't have all the tools in the toolbox and the toolbox on the table so that you can utilize the tools that are best for the job. Now, I believe strongly that we not only need to conserve energy and build more wind and other renewable options, but we also need a very strong base load component. I don't believe that coal technology in itself can fill that void. I don't believe that gasification plants by itself can fill that void, nor nuclear. But I think that we do need a good mix. And nuclear power in other countries on this planet is moving forward. France, for example, clearly over 80% of all their electricity is generated through nuclear means. They reprocess their fuel, and they don't have a problem or much of an issue, I should say, with nuclear power per se. You know, the United States is one of the few industrialized nuclear countries in the world that does not reprocess their fuel. I think that's a crying shame. One, it adds to the overall metric tons of spent nuclear fuel that has to be stored and stored safely someplace. We're not going to be able to reduce the amount that we have currently, but if we were able to reprocess, that means we don't have to go out and strip mine for uranium in places like Africa and other third world countries where conditions aren't quite as nice as they are here in the United States. The reprocessing of nuclear fuel is... like I said, it's done in other countries. Most of the questions about the technology surrounding this reprocessing have been answered. You can take roughly 100% of the material, reprocess it, and glean about 92% of the overall material and reuse it. And, you know, that's part of the policy that we've been going through since the 70s is recycle, reuse, and try to use the whatever material it is, plastic, paper, nuclear fuel, use it more than once. Continue to use it until its life expectancy has been extracted from it. There's also other valuable types of metals that can be extracted from this material. Granted, it's only a very small part, but they're very... what's the word? They're very rare types of metals that other industries are able to use. And so there is a little bit of a spinoff, just not the nuclear end of the business. After fuel has reached at the end of its life cycle at the Savannah River Nuclear Facility, just across the little creek there from Augusta National, the federal government takes the waste or the used spent fuel from nuclear reactors that are on ships, subs, stuff like that, and they vitrify it, which...
Senator Murphy, I'm going to ask you to stick to the point at this time, because we have a number of bills to hear and a lot of testimony. So,
all right. Well,
Senator Vanderveer has a question, too.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know, Senator Murphy, if you know, but Prairie Island, we're talking about the spent fuel. How many cubic feet have they produced, like, in the 40 years? Because they're storing that all on site, aren't they?
Madam Chairman, Senator Vanderveer, yes, they store their material on site. Monticello at one time back in the early 90s, late 80s, sent a shipment down to Morris, Illinois. But the fuel that's been used at Prairie Island is all still there. I don't know how many metric tons off the top of my head that is, but at one time, and this is before they started utilizing the CAS, the TN40 dry cast storage system, all of that was in a swimming pool inside the plant that is roughly the size of an Olympic-sized swimming pool. And that was the material at the time, and that, I don't know, the last time I was there was, it's been several years back now, but, yeah, it's a very, if you look at it in metric tons, it seems like a lot, but when they're sitting in those casts and you can see it, then you know exactly how much it is, and it's...
Maybe
it's,
we need to get somebody from Xcel to get that answer for you. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Murphy, I'll talk to you about the vitrifying of those at some other time, but I am interested then, because we did have testimony last time that the ban on reprocessing from the federal level was lifted under President Reagan, if I remember right. So do you hear of any efforts to go towards reprocessing?
Senator Murphy?
Madam Chairman, only one that comes out of my mouth.
Senator Murphy, that was my question, too.
That's one big...
That was my question, too, is I believe that Xcel or whoever wished to go toward further nuclear energy could do a business plan and a needs assessment of their own. Why should the state take this on at this time?
Well, Madam Chairman, I think it would be helpful for the legislature to have the information at hand. I'm not talking about, you know, we're going to subsidize this in any way, shape, or form. Because I believe the experts in the industry can tell you that if they're given a level playing field, that they could make that work. Is it an expensive endeavor? Yes, it is. Does it offset the cost of shipping new fuel, mining for new fuel? I doubt that because it's pretty cheap to strip mine almost anything. But once again, we're talking about trying to keep the overall volume that we have at a manageable level. If we continue to go and not use some sort of reprocessing, we're going to have more and more material, and I don't, you know, it's just a personal opinion, and there's probably people that disagree, but I don't think that that would be, I just don't think that that's a good long-range plan. I think long-range we do need to move towards recycling this product. I mean, it's a valuable product. It's a good asset, and you know, most economists will tell you that, you know, talking about base load electricity, you know, for every dollar of gross national product, you need 6 watts of electricity. That's just the way it works out. And if we want to continue to move the state and the nation forward economically, we need to have a good base load system of electricity.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't particularly see Xcel as extremely creative. I wonder if sometimes they don't spend a lot of time just implementing what they're told by the legislature, you know, to, you know, buy wind from here and pay this much. And maybe we should tell them they'd have to buy nuclear and have somebody else actually build the plant. It might be one.
So you take a different tact. I'm saying why should we remove the moratorium until there is evidence that there is somebody that wants to, or until and unless somebody comes to us with evidence they want to move in that direction. But
sure.
You're saying push them in that direction.
We kind of do, with regard to other renewables and things like that. And I don't know, maybe we taught them not to worry about it and just do what they're told. I'm not saying that's a fact, but it could be that they're more afraid or not interested or whatever in pursuing, especially nuclear, that hasn't been extremely popular. I think it's getting more consideration now because people realize that it is clean and there's a lot of it. And gas, I mean, using a small point source like that for power is extremely, I think, questionable policy. So looking for clean fuels is certainly a priority.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair, just to kind of defend the electric industry a little bit, in regards to what Senator Vandiver had said, they most of the ones that are in Minnesota, and I know that one company in particular, have been extremely creative of trying to open up markets for basically for renewable energies. Most of these power companies, they get it. They see that a portion of their profit is moving towards that renewable end, and there are companies, and there's leaders of some of those companies. One of them happens to be the leader of XL that believes strongly that that's the way the company should be. They should be spending a portion of their business, directly engaged in those renewable endeavors. And that's why these plants here, that's why these plants here in the metropolitan area are not going to burn coal in the future. They're going to use gas, and why there's a few other things going around. I mean,
We have to move along now. So, Senator Rummel.
Just a quick question, Madam Chair and Senator Murphy, and I apologize if I missed this. It looks like this bill is requiring or extending the sunset date for a legislative electric energy task force. Mm-hmm. Is there a current task force in place?
Yes.
Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, yes, there is. And I think Senator Anderson can probably tell you it was in her bill. There's an extension for that that was established in the 1994 Prairie Island legislation.
So it's still an ongoing, alive.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator Rummel, I believe you're a member.
Oh, I am. Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't know who has been appointed
Senator
this year.
Anderson. Besides
myself.
Senator Metzen and myself, mm-hmm. and Senator Rosen. Carlson. Senator Rosen.
Well, Madam Chair, I know who wasn't.
Is it a sub?
Madam Chair, all I wanted
Senator
to
Anderson.
Add is that Senator Metzen had asked that we extend the sunset. So I had offered that into our omnibus bill that we passed. So the extension is there for, I can't recall, how many years? Four years.
Out.
Thank you.
I have a copy on my desk. I'll notify people next week.
And
that's good.
And Madam Chair, if I could just mention something else too, the Prairie Island Indian community is also here today, and we and you're one of the co-authors, and Senator Anderson is one of the co-authors of a resolution to memorialize Congress to kind of move ahead in trying to consolidate the nuclear waste all around the country at the Yucca Mountain site. And our resolution went in this week, and it went over to the Rules Committee, and that's why it's not here. But they're here to provide testimony, I believe, on this. And I think Mr. Johnson is also going to talk about that resolution, kind of walk us through that.
Why don't we move on to your next bill, then?
Madam Chairman, the next bill is pretty easy to explain. It's part one of the bill I just explained, which is taking the, handing it off to the Public Utilities Commission.
Okay. So it's a portion of the former bill. Are there any other questions or comments by committee members? Okay. Senator Murphy, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
There are two bills by Senator Jungbauer that are similar to Senator Murphy's bill. Senator Jungbauer had a family emergency, I believe, and is unable to be with us today. We did offer him the opportunity to have somebody else present his bills, but he said that he was satisfied with Senator Murphy's bills.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Senator Cooley's gone too, so are we going to hear his bills too then? Or?
We did hear his bills.
Although he sat through the whole meeting, that's right.
Yes, we did hear Senator Cooley's three bills last Tuesday. And Senator Anderson has an amendment to her bill, so why don't we work on that at this point?
Madam Chair, I have the A3 amendment.
And Senator Anderson's bill, when did we heard it? About a week ago, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. Do you want? So, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
As you'll recall, members, my bill is started with the language that is in the omnibus bill that passed off the floor that puts an additional fee on the nuclear waste cast at Monticello should they be approved and cited there. And it also, XL and I had been working out a compromise on this, and they had proposed the idea of getting cost recovery in an expedited way for their investments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And there were some concerns raised in the committee about how broad that language was, that section of the bill about the cost recovery. And so we worked out a compromise on this. And I know Bill Grant and worked with XL lobbyists, with Rick Evans and others, to work out some language on this. And that's the A3 amendment that you see in front of you. And it also, well, basically what it does is it limits this option to two circumstances. One would be for replacement of cast iron natural gas distribution and service lines, and the second is to replace breakers that contain sodium hexafluoride. And I think you'd have to ask the utility to come forward to explain what that really involves, because I have heard it briefly, but I'm not super familiar with the details.
And the important thing is that it's in the public's interest that these be replaced.
Yes, Madam Chair. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that I know that you had expressed concern about having, in general, about having more inclusive policies that cover more utilities. And so the lobbyists, I think, talk with each other, and it's our understanding that the gas companies were interested in at least being included in this so that they would have the option. This is completely optional for a utility. It's not required or expected, but it just gives them the option to take advantage of this as well. So that's why the language includes a utility furnishing gas service as well. And then, as you said, Madam Chair, they could only do this after the PUC agreed that the project would be consistent with the public interest and does not impose excessive costs on customers. And then they could approve recovery for these specific types of projects. So, Madam Chair, do you want to have a brief explanation of what these entail?
Is there somebody from XL that would like to come up? Mr. Alders, if you just give your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Alders from XL Energy. I don't know that there's a whole lot more to add. I think that was a very good summary. Indeed, we have old cast iron pipe in our gas distribution system, and by replacing it, we can reduce the amount of natural gas that leaks from those systems and thus reduce carbon emissions. In addition, we have breakers and primarily breakers in this case, that have a gas, this sodium hexafluoride, that's an insulator in those breakers. And inevitable that some of that will leak over time. And indeed, we can replace that gas with another gas that has less of a greenhouse signature.
Senator Alsayn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When these these cast iron lines are leaking underground, where does the gas go? Does it stay in the ground or work up into the atmosphere? Or?
Mr. Alders.
Madam Chair, Senator, it works its way up into the atmosphere over time.
Okay. Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does normal depreciation, it doesn't include pipes lasting a certain amount of time, that's not normally taken into consideration in rate recovery? I'm not a real expert in this area, so I'm just kind of curious. It seems that the pipes would have a limited life. The lines do, the breakers do, and that there'd be a normal schedule, a replacement schedule. That's not the case here.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Alders.
Senator Vandermeer, indeed there is a depreciation schedule for all of those capital investments, but if indeed they're serviceable after they've been depreciated, they continue to be used. We don't replace just because they've reached the end of their economic life. We continue to monitor their performance. So,
Madam Chair, isn't there already a rate recovery in the if it's being depreciated over time? Isn't the current rate give you recovery for that period of time so that if you get extra time, that's like a bonus? Then why would we be paying for that? What am I missing here?
Mr. Alders?
Senator, the amount of depreciation that has occurred is built into rates, and indeed some portions of our rate base have been eliminated, so prices and rates go down to account for those, in this case the gas pipes, but there's other portions of our business where costs are increasing and those exceed the decreases. The situation here is that we have to make major new investments, and so we're looking for the opportunity to get the cost recovery for those new investments at the same time those investments are being made.
Any further questions? Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and testifier, what's the mechanism of the leaks today from the cast iron pipes? Is that gaskets, cracks, or what's the problem with them? And then what are they being replaced with, and what's the life of those?
Mr. Alders.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have all those details. I can get them for you. In general, it's no different than the cast iron that was used in your sewer systems in your homes years ago, or even today, where the joints aren't as tight as long plastic pipes that are used today. Where there are no joints, and where there are joints, they're sealed by welding or gluing. Cast iron in the ground over time due to all of the forces that occur, including freeze and thaw, will loosen up over time. Just and so those joints will indeed loosen up to some degree.
Madam Chair, it's primarily the joints then?
That's my understanding.
Okay. Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, what's the other part of the question? What are they being replaced with?
It's either high-density plastic piping that it comes out in big, long reels, and so you don't have the same number of joints that you do with the older cast iron systems. And in terms of its economic life, I don't know what that is, but I would assume it's as longer than the old cast iron systems.
Okay. Then on the A3 amendment, Senator Anderson renews her motion. Any further questions? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On Senator Anderson's amended Senate File 2199, then, any further questions or comments? Senator Polk.
Madam Chair and members, I assume we're going to now vote on this.
Yes.
So if you'll just indulge me for a little bit, because I don't believe that this situation, although it is about the Monticello plant and their storage, that it will affect all of our constituents, because half of XL covers fully half of the state. And also, energy reliability and environmental impacts, of course, affect all residents of the state of Minnesota. And I think we have to think of exactly what we're doing here. And, of course, everything we do sends a message. And there was a strong message sent in 1994 when XL was charged originally the $16 million. But lots of things have changed, and we've heard about that. And I'll list a few of those. First of all, the dry cast storage has now been tested. It was a new technology then. It's been tested. It's been improved upon. We heard that 26 states now use dry cast storage and that there are 800 casks in use. Well, I have down we're closer to Yucca Mountain question mark, so we won't really touch upon that. Also, per the commissioner, our plants now, as they've gone along in age, have become remarkably efficient, and their efficiency has improved dramatically, was his statement. The potential for reprocessing, I believe, has been improved, and we've heard that as well. In fact, the commissioner also said, the Public Utilities Commissioner said, that we're not necessarily dealing with a waste, but a future resource. Renewable energy in 1994 was very new, and that fund that was started really kicked things off for the state of Minnesota. But we know now that we passed tremendously aggressive renewable energy legislation earlier in this session. And so really the process is not in need of the kickstart that it was in 1994. So this is additional overcharge to our consumers. And then finally, things have shifted because of our need for carbon-free baseload power. And I'm just going to refer, and I don't know if everyone got this, but the NCSL, which is the National Council of State Legislators, not a conservative, radically conservative group by any means, had an article in March. It's called The Nuclear Renaissance. And it talks in there about the 30 different nuclear plants going up. It talks about the Department of Energy and their efforts to work on reusing, recycling nuclear fuel. And I'm just going to read to you a little bit here really quickly. That nuclear energy is the world's largest source of emission-free energy. It produces no controlled air pollutants, such as sulfur and particulates or greenhouse gases. In 2005, U.S. nuclear power plants prevented 3.32 million tons of sulfur dioxide, 1.05 million tons of nitrogen oxide, and 681.9 million metric tons of carbon dioxide from entering the Earth's atmosphere. I think we're looking at things a little differently. And this legislation, I guess what I'm asking is that maybe we step back and just send a little message. I'm not saying that we should start a nuclear power plant. I'm not suggesting that we roll back the $16 million that Xcel is already paying. I'm just suggesting that maybe we don't need the additional overcharge. Maybe we can just send a very little tiny message that nuclear energy maybe, just maybe, could just be left on the table as a possible option down the road, instead of sending the message that, no, nuclear power is bad, anybody who has it must be punished. And I feel like that's kind of what we're doing with the legislation. So I just ask members to consider that when you're looking at this. Also consider that all the costs, additional costs to the utilities, are eventually passed down to the consumers. And that's what's going to happen in this instance. And so I would, I'd like to ask you to vote no.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, well, I guess I agree, Senator Koch, with one thing that you said, and that's that Yucca Mountain's a big question mark. And, you know, in 94, we kept hearing it's getting, you know, it's only a few years off. And then when we revisited again in 2003, we learned that it's further off than it was then. And so it may or may not provide a solution. But I think, and as I recall from the discussion that we had in 2003 when we first discussed relicensure of both of the plants, Prairie Island primarily in 2003, but we talked about both of the plants, that the testimony at that time was that under the plans for Yucca Mountain, there wouldn't be storage capacity for waste that was generated from an additional 20-year period. That Yucca Mountain, if it did open, would have enough room for the current plants under their current licenses, but that it wouldn't be able to store more waste. And so even if it opens, we don't have any certainty that it will have a place to go, even if Yucca Mountain opens. And so, you know, I think, as you said, you're absolutely correct, Senator Koch, that there is a lot more renewed interest in nuclear power. And I think we'll be hearing more and more about it. And I think it's appropriate always to have a discussion and to be open to solutions. But I also think that we're kind of fooling ourselves if we ignore the waste issue. Because it's one thing to talk about the potential of nuclear power and the generation of it being clean, but it can never be clean when we have what we have, which is highly dangerous and toxic waste that's highly toxic and dangerous for generations, and it's stuck in our state, and it's in your district and in Senator Murphy's district, and it's going to be there for a really, really long time, and nobody really knows how long. And so that's the concern that the legislature was facing, whether we might be host to this permanently, and there could be consequences. And so that was part of the underlying reason for the policy. So I don't think – I appreciate that Xcel is not coming and asking us to suspend the RDF payments, and that they have actually been very open to this compromise, and I really appreciate that. We've come up with a compromise that they've agreed to and that I support, and similar language, not exactly the same, is in the House bill. And, you know, I'd appreciate it if we could continue this policy that's in place, and maybe someday we can revisit it. When we've solved that waste problem, that's when I'll be willing to revisit it. But right now, we have a problem, and the Renewable Development Fund has done so much good, and it's still doing so much good to support the growth of the renewable energy industry that we're going to need that support as all the utilities have to work so hard to move forward to meet their requirements. And, you know, and it's been doing some of the underlying research that's needed to get that work done. And so I hope members will support us moving this position forward and recommend it from the committee. And then when we go to the conference committee, we can make sure that people know that the Senate committee has discussed this and is comfortable with the policy.
Is this a response?
Just a little.
Senator Koch.
Well, and Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I'm certainly not ignoring the waste problem. It's in my district. It's few miles from my parents' home. And I'm co-author on Senator Murphy's resolution to keep Yucca Mountain moving. I'm very interested in working on safe transportation of nuclear spent fuels. And those are the areas that I would rather see us focus on. And I recognize all the good things that the Development Fund has doing. And I'm not suggesting we take away the current fund. I'm just saying, is it necessary for the additional overcharge? Do we need to have our consumers pay for that? I know that Xcel is perhaps hammered out the agreement, but eventually it's the consumers that pay for it. And can we just let the issue be, is what I'm suggesting. Leave it as it is.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to concur with Senator Koch. I'm not certain why we need the additional overcharge here, because with carbon emissions, we have a problem that's going to last hundreds, maybe thousands of years as well, as we know, and it's a waste problem that we can't contain. At least with nuclear power, we have it contained at a certain spot that we can do something with. We may need, you know, to deal with how we're going to deal with how the supply as it continues to grow, but reprocessing has been an issue. And if we were going to use additional monies, I would think that it would be maybe more prudent to use it in ways to how to deal with the waste from nuclear power. Because it seems to me, as we look at, you know, down in the landscape here ahead, with baseload needs and the need to reduce our carbon emissions, nuclear is going to be much, much more in play, and we should be dealing with that, finding ways to deal with that waste issue. But I'm not sure that putting an additional charge here that solves that problem at this point or addresses it the way we would like to.
Senator Vandiver.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the fact that Xcel doesn't oppose it, I mean, don't they just go to the PUC and they let them put it on the electric bill? I think that's, you know, why they maybe aren't that excited about it, and they would like to continue running the plant. There are some good things in the bill, but I'm wondering if we couldn't delete line 120 to 2.2. Mr. Fuller, would that still work if we deleted that section? Because my constituents are paying for it, and yours are, and it's a penalty for doing something that doesn't look that bad to me. Looking at the options, would the bill still work with that removed?
Madam Chair.
Just a minute, Senator Anderson. Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair,
You need your microphone.
Madam Chair, Senator Vanderveer, I think what you would do then, if you wanted to keep the fund charges at the status quo, you would eliminate the new language on page 1, line 20 to 24, the language on 2.1 to 2.2, restore the stricken B on line 3 on page 2, and delete the new language. Restore the stricken language on line 2.5 to 2.11 and delete the new language on those lines. And then because I believe the language on 1.16 to 1.19 is not connected to that. So that's your intent, is to keep the current funding situation as it is in current law, correct?
That would be my intent, yes.
Okay, so Senator Vanderveer has a motion. The chair intends to support Senator Anderson and to maintain the integrity of the resolution or the bill as it was introduced. And the reason that I'm doing this is because it's consistent with previous law for Prairie Island, and it also was a compromise agreement that was worked out with the utility company. So I wanted you to know that the chair intends to support Senator Anderson's bill as it is here. Senator Olsen?
Is there a cap on the $350,000? Because from the materials we got from Excel showed by like 2030, I think they're talking about having 30 of these dry casks at Monticello. So I figure that would be a little over $10 million, $10.5 million per year. So there really isn't a cap then. It would just depend on how many storage units are actually on site, and the $350,000 would be to the unit. Okay. That's correct interpretation?
That's correct. Mr. Fuller?
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's determined. The amount of the annual payment, if the plant's in operation, is determined by the number of casks.
Okay. On Senator Vanderveer's motion, then,
we'd want a roll call on this, if we could, ma'am.
We will have a roll call. Basically deleting Section B and then correcting the language.
Senator Prettner Solon?
No.
Senator Anderson?
No.
Senator Carlson?
No.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Dahl?
Yes.
Senator Koch?
Yes.
Senator Olsen?
No.
Senator Rummel?
No.
Senator Sharon?
No.
Senator Vanderveer?
Yes.
And the motion fails on a 3-6 vote. Then on the bill itself, Senator Anderson renews her motion that Senate File 2199 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. Mm-hmm. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Oh.
The motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members.
At this time, we will begin testimony, and we have a number of people who are scheduled to testify. I'm asking that you keep your comments concise, to the point, and not repeat one another. And the first speaker is Cecilia Martinez. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
A
My name is Dr. Cecilia Martinez. I am currently a senior policy fellow for the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy. That center is located at the University of Delaware and has been in existence for over 20 years. We do research and are actually a contributor to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And have done work and research and technical assistance to a number of countries, as well as states domestically in the United States, and communities. I was asked today to give some testimony regarding the issue that has been raised repeatedly by some of you regarding nuclear power as an alternative to the issue of climate change. Nuclear power, as we know, is being cited as one potential option for the reduction of CO2 emissions for this country. And rather than focus on potential studies, I think we have the opportunity, given nuclear's existence around the world internationally, to actually see some concrete examples, some concrete data about what the effect of nuclear power is on CO2 emissions. And I think you'll be rather surprised when I show you some of this data. If you look, I have prepared a small packet for you of just 6 pages of information. The first page is pretty self-explanatory. You're all familiar with it. They come from the IPCC and the Kyoto Protocol. The percentage of emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, that we need to reduce to stabilize the atmosphere. We need to reduce carbon dioxide by more than 60% in this country. And if you go to the second page, what we've done is we've given you a graph that shows developed countries, Annex 1 countries, at the time of Kyoto Protocol, and what it really means if we're talking about social equity on a global basis. We talk about globalization. We talk about the advantage of markets. And as we talk about economic globalization, I think it's incumbent upon us as a democratic nation to also talk about justice and equity issues, as well as economic issues regarding globalization. Toward that end, what we've done is we've prepared a graph that shows you if we look at greenhouse gas emissions on a per capita basis and we compare those with Annex 1 versus non-Annex 1 countries, the developing world, the red line is the Annex 1 countries. In order to get to the stabilization of the atmosphere, Annex 1 countries to reduce by 60%, we would need to reach per capita emissions in this country of approximately 3.3 tons. You can see where we are at in the graph, which is nowhere near 3.3 tons. When you look at the non-Annex 1 countries, the difference currently between those two lines in the year 2005 is pretty substantial. In fact, in terms of equity, what the international community is saying is the developing world would actually have to increase its carbon emissions to engage in equitable economic development. If you look at the figures on the side there to 2050, given population projections, you see that, in fact, in order for us to stabilize the atmosphere, it would mean worldwide an actual 2.0 tons per capita in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And if you look at the following graph, what we've done is we've put, you can see the line where that 3.3 is. Anything above it, we have called debtor nations. When we're talking about carbon emissions, in other words, it is draining the viability of the atmosphere. It is a debt to the global atmosphere. And you can see the Annex 1 countries, where they stand graphically in terms of debtor nations to our atmosphere. Obviously, the below the line are those nations who still do not, on a per capita basis, emit those 3.3 tons. And in that sense, if we look at it that way, they are actually credit nations. To go to the next page, to talk directly about nuclear's impact. We have chosen to show you three concrete examples, Japan, South Korea, and France. All of these nations have invested substantially in their nuclear energy system. And to begin with, when we look at Japan and we look at the carbon emissions relative to its nuclear capacity, you can see that even with the increase in nuclear capacity, carbon emissions for Japan continues to increase, even as the nuclear energy system continues to increase. Japan is known as one of the most efficient economies in the world. Currently, it gets approximately 28% of its electricity from nuclear power, and still it has not been able to, despite that high figure, be able to reverse its carbon emissions. If we go to the next slide, South Korea. South Korea experienced one of the most rapid economic growth economies in the recent decades. They, too, also invested substantially in terms of nuclear power capacity. If you look at equally their record, you can see even they, as nuclear power capacity increases, carbon emissions continue to increase. Exactly the opposite of what we're told in terms of the capacity for nuclear power to reduce carbon emissions and have an impact on climate change and global warming. This data is not hypothetical data. It's not futuristic data. It's actually data based on past experience. Perhaps the most stunning case of this is France. I heard earlier testimony regarding France and its nuclear power. France has a nuclear power, its energy system, is approximately 75% nuclear power. And I just want to go through this this slide with you and explain it a little bit because it is somewhat complicated. If you look at France in 1990, its emissions were about 100 million tons. In order to achieve the goals of Kyoto Protocol, they would need to reduce their emissions by 60% by mid-century, which would mean that their target would be 40 million tons by 2050. They are currently at 110 million tons of carbon emissions and climbing, despite a 75% nuclear energy sector. With this in mind, what France would need to do, if we buy the argument that nuclear power is going to have a significant effect on climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, France would have to go from 75% nuclear power generation to 100% nuclear power generation, a 25% increase. And any energy economist and energy planner will tell you that to rely solely on a single fuel source for its electricity production is bad business. Yet, in order to deal with climate change, if we are to follow that argument, that's exactly what France would need to do. Thus, even at 100% nuclear scenario, it is absurd to think that France would be able to reduce its now climbing carbon emissions to 40 million tons per year. The conclusion that I want to leave you with is that if we make these arguments on very narrow energy technology choices, we begin to miss the bigger picture of what we're talking about in terms of an energy-reliant and energy-dependent society as well as an equitable society. If you build a $4 billion nuclear power plant, the last thing you want to do is not use electrical energy. If you build a $4 billion power plant, you encourage the use of electrical energy. And all the devices that are used in order to use that energy, all the plastics, all the DVDs, all the television sets, Everything that you use to consume that electricity is carbon intensive. And that is what these graphs are showing you. Not only that these things are carbon intensive, but also nuclear power won't deal with one of the most significant effects of climate change, which is the transport sector. So I hope that this information has given you a little food for thought in terms of the argument of nuclear power being a clean energy source, and encourage you to look at the existing data internationally about the relationship between reduction of carbon emissions and the nuclear power sector. Thank you very much.
Dr. Martinez or Martinez?
Martinez.
Martinez. I think we need perhaps a little more information. I'm not sure that anyone was ever really suggesting that we should go totally nuclear.
Correct.
But can you? What would this look like if there were a comparison between nuclear and coal-powered plants, for instance? This is suggesting that there is carbon emission from nuclear energy, or if because we're a carbon-based society, that whether this were even all wind energy, we'd see a similar type of graph.
Correct. One of the implications that we're trying to show here is that you really need to look at the overall structure of the energy system. And Minnesota, as you know, is a leader in this field in terms of its recent energy legislation. Building distributed energy systems are much more efficient, are less carbon intensive, but you cannot just look at technology by technology to solve the energy problem. And that's what we're trying to suggest here.
You're saying that we need to look at all sources of carbon emission in the state.
Correct. We need to look at transportation. You need to look at planning. You need to look at the variety of carbon emissions that go along with it.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions, Senator Olsen?
Well, I appreciated your question, Madam Chair. But following up on that, though, what about, you know, like our chair suggested we see the tape about who killed the electric car. So are you saying that, because I don't think it's reasonable to expect our society to give up our computers, our refrigerators, and all of these kinds of things. But there may be ways to still have transportation more efficiently. So.
Correct. And planning systems that encourage efficiency around transport, public transportation systems. There's a whole variety of things. My only point is to point out to you, I was asked to testify and give you information about the relationship between nuclear power and carbon emissions. And that's what I've done.
So I think the chair makes a really good point that if this was all generated from coal, that your other line would be way off the charts.
Exactly. But if that's the only, that's not the only alternative, which I'm trying to suggest here. You have alternative energy sources, renewable energy sources, which you've already demonstrated for the state as a leader in that field. But if you go to a high consumptive nuclear power, by definition, if you're going to spend that amount of money, that scale of money to produce a power plant, economic sense tells you that you want to sell more electricity. Why would you build a $4 billion plant to conserve energy? It doesn't make economic sense. And so by continuing on a high-cost, centralized electrical sector, you actually begin to encourage more consumption rather than to encourage conservation or alternative renewable.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I appreciate the last comment because I wasn't quite yet grasping the point or the what we're supposed to get out of the presentation. Other than an earlier point, which I think is a point that we've had some discussion on in this committee already, and that's a point upon which we all, I think, energetically agree, and that is that as we look to control carbon emissions, we have to look across all sectors, that we can't confine our comments and our policy initiatives to solely the electrical energy generation sector. And so I think she's affirming that we're on the right track in the variety of approaches that people are proposing. And she also confirms that we're on the right track with the establishment of the renewable energy standard and the conservation and efficiency bill. It probably would do us some good to spend some more time talking about some of the more global ideas about whether or not, you know, creating more electrical energy baseload like this creates more demand. I don't know much about that, or you know, I'd like to learn more if someone has a perspective on that. And something we haven't spent a lot of time on, other than maybe in seabed, in some other places, or some of the biomass stuff that we've touched on a little bit, or the local small hydro, and that's some of the distributed small energy power, community based and others, which we haven't spent. Maybe we can delve into that sometime in the future or next year. It's pretty interesting. I'm very very superficial in my knowledge of that whole area of conversation around energy generation.
Well, it certainly points out to the fact that the whole idea of conservation and energy efficiency is very broad and very global. And we've been taking it piecemeal. We're focusing on nuclear right now. But when it comes to actually looking at our policy, we have to broaden out. We have to take all of this information together and not be so narrow-focused. Thank you very much. The next speaker is Leah Fauché. So when I met you today, I didn't know you were also speaking.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Leah Fauché. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Board of the North American Water Office, and I thank you for inviting me to come here today and speak with you. I'm talking today about the routine radioactive releases that Xcel Energy, whether it's at Prairie Island or Monticello, is allowed to put into our air, our water, our soil, and our bodies. Unfortunately, I've not been able to duplicate the huge pile for everyone. I can send it to you all electronically if you would so desire. I've provided one copy to the chair. Madam Chair, you have the full copy of what I will address. But I have made available one document for everyone that I would like to talk about. I have been following routine emissions from the reactors for quite a very long period of time. Our organization has been in existence for 25 years. We celebrate our 25th anniversary of founding this year. And in so doing, I have amassed an incredible amount of paper that I have to manage because I repeatedly need to use it. And it's very hard to get. The internet makes some of it easier to get, but I frequently have to use the Freedom of Information Act to gain access to materials because the federal government on some of the older documents simply can't find them anymore. And then I'm asked to go to the health department and ask them for those documents. And in my packet, there is a letter that I submitted in 2005 to gain access to information for the Certificate of Need proceeding on Monticello dry cask storage. And it was disturbing beyond belief, because if you look at some of the routine releases that have been historic for these very long-lived radioactive isotopes. And in 1974, for example, it was 1,570,000 curies. And nobody really even today even knows about that. And it's only because I started looking for it that I even know about it. In 1975, it was still 155,000 curies. And I think at that time, we had a back to the drawing board, boys, because things had to change dramatically, and the whole plant was redesigned and reconfigured. Fortunately for us as human beings on this earth, because I don't think that we would still be here if we were still emitting 1.5 million curies a year. The Beer 7, now this is the National Academies of Science, and they periodically put out this study on low-level ionizing radiation. And this is the document that I passed out to everyone. And on page 3, figure 2, it says, in a lifetime, approximately 42 of 100 people will be diagnosed with cancer from causes unrelated to radiation. The calculations in this report suggest approximately one cancer in 100 people could result from a single exposure of 100 millisieverts of low-level radiation. Nuclear power is not clean, it is not safe, and it causes cancer. And they are releasing radioactive emissions all the time. All the time. Sometimes it's thousands of curies, sometimes it's million, like I said. Fortunately, in the last few years, it has only been hundreds. But they still release it. And it is still available for absorption into plants, into animals, into women and children, and even gentlemen here of the committee. What the Beer 7 suggests is that women and children are much more susceptible to this than men, adult men, and I would offer to you that we are poisoning. As an indigenous woman, I must stand and say that we are poisoning the next 7 generations of our children. The next 7 generations of our children. And we cannot allow this. We cannot allow this. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions or comments by committee members? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, can you help me what these emissions are exactly? I guess I really am not sure what they are.
Well,
Ms. Foshi?
All sorts of them. Tritium in particular is one of the primary emissions that we have released into the air at Monticello. Tritium has a half-life of maybe 12.5 years. So the emissions that were put out in 1994, half of them are still around. Half of them are still around. Tritium is absorbed by the skin. It's been known to cause Down syndrome in children and other health problems. If you want to look at the very large document that I provided the Madam Chair, it talks about all the suite of radioactive isotopes that are released, and it gives scientific notation. This huge pile, it gives you the scientific notation, and the layperson on the street will look at that, and it won't make any sense at all because it's very small numbers, but then they put an E and a plus and a zero or a minus zero or some other strange configuration behind it. And so you have to do all the calculations in with the arithmetic to figure it out.
Ms. Foshi,
yes,
what
madam.
Accounts for the reduction since 1974 in the emissions?
I would hope they learned how to run their plant.
Okay. Are you aware of changes that...
They had to redesign their entire plant, ma'am.
Okay. Senator Rama.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Fauché. In what form are, I mean, is it accidents? Is it just leakage? What are we talking about when you...
Deliberate release.
Because?
Because that's what, in order for the plant to operate, they have to release routine emissions or you cannot operate the plant. Most of these are in gaseous form or liquid form. The gaseous form has to be released. They hold it. They have a holding tank where they keep it, and they don't tell anybody when they're going to release it, not even the health department. They advise me that the health department doesn't even know when they're going to release it, but there are routine releases, and they do it every year, every year.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fauché, on these, the Department of Health, as far as I understand, I've got a pamphlet here that says they've been testing for radiation exposure and leakage and things of that nature for some time and found that there's acceptable levels. There isn't any unacceptable levels that are occurring at these plants. I mean, and the testimony you're giving is indicating that that's not the case. Do you have some other information that would refute what the Department of Health is saying?
Senator Dahl, they simply don't look for it. The methodology that they employ using thermolescent dulcimeters are gamma ray detectors. All the isotopes that we're talking about, they're not all gamma ray detectors. And so if you really want to find out where those emissions go, you would have to do a different monitoring program, which we are trying to make. We have been trying to make the state of Minnesota and the health department do for over 10 years to do a different type of monitoring program where they can actually detect where the emissions, because this is not, I haven't made up these emission reports. These are emission reports that NSP, now XL, now NMC, has to file with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on a biannual basis. Twice a year, they have to submit this material. So I have not made this up. This is not my information. It is the utilities' calculations and data. The State Department of Health, if this radiation were not an acceptable level of risk, if you were not sacrificing your firstborn son for this, and it could very well be your firstborn son that contracts a leukemia from this radiation and dies, you could very likely not operate that plant. You have to be willing to sacrifice someone in order to run this. I'm not willing to sacrifice my firstborn son or anyone else's.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking, and I appreciate you, and I'm not trying to dispute what you're saying, because it may be that we have to look at other areas where these emissions are occurring and what health effects they have. But even on this handout that you gave us, I'm looking down here on the figure one says that 79% of the exposure we have are from medical rays and nuclear medical devices, and only 5% really account for the nuclear fuel cycle. And so are we really being exposed to that degree of that big of a risk, or should we be looking at other areas instead of if we're going to spend time and money on things to find out where we're having health effects, it seems to me that that's a really minor part of what we're really being exposed to overall.
Senator Dahl, Madam Chair, there is no safe dose. That's what Beer 7 says. There is no safe dose. Every dose that you allow into the biosphere, into your air, into your water, into your soils and food, every dose that you allow has the potential of causing a cancer. If it's the alpha particles or the beta particles that get inside the body, those are the ones that we are most concerned about. Those are the ones that cause the biological damage that are the long-lived fraction. And we simply don't know where those isotopes go in Minnesota. And we don't seem to care. We don't seem to care. And I think that that is not a correct position to take.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question related to this Beer 7 handout as well. I was just trying to understand the relationship of this figure 1, the amount of man-made radiation, and then the subset that, you know, shows how that's broken out between X-rays and nuclear medicine and consumer products and the nuclear fuel cycle, and how that related to the figure 2 that you called our attention to, the single star. Is it safe to say that that star, which is the person who gets cancer from a single exposure to low-level radiation, occurs across this variety of types of exposure? I mean, it could occur from any one or any combination of those, or is that – I haven't read the full document, so I'm just trying to pull information off quickly here, and I'm going to take some more time with it. Or is that star – is that person getting cancer from the nuclear waste that we're aware of that's being released?
Ms. Fouché.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble. They are relating all nuclear exposure. We aren't just talking nuclear power, obviously. And as I said, there is no safe dose. And I have provided you with the number of curies that we are allowing into our air and our water. And so the whole point is, are we willing to accept this continued nuclear operation and this continued release? We in the Twin Cities, for example, are in the double exposure zone. If you were to draw a circle around Monticello and a circle around Prairie Island, there are counties in the metro area that receive the airshed in the 50-mile zone from both reactors. So we are doubly exposed in the Twin Cities, in my opinion.
Thank you. The next speaker is Diane Rother. Dr. Rother. It's okay.
Thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Diane Rother. I am a holistic health practitioner with a PhD in holistic nutrition from Clayton School of Natural Healing, as well as certification in massage therapy, acupressure, biofeedback, electrodermal screening, and thermography. I am also a board member of the North American Water Office. The continuation of nuclear power within this country and this state relies upon only one premise, public acceptance. Ask yourself, does public acceptance exist only because the true cost of nuclear energy is hidden and overlooked? One aspect of these hidden costs is the cost to our health caused by the daily, routine radioactive releases from a nuclear power plant. Specific information on the health effects of routine releases were included in the folder of information we received from North American Water Office. I had handed these out previously. Also in the handout that you have, there's a list of different releases connected to nuclear power plants and the health effects that they can have. To continue, I quote from the book, No Immediate Danger by Rosalie Bertel. the cellular damage caused by internally deposited radioactive particles becomes manifest as a health effect related to the particular organ damage. For example, radionuclides lodged in the bones can damage bone marrow and cause bone cancer or leukemia, while radionuclides lodged in the lungs can cause respiratory diseases. Generalized whole body exposure to radiation can be expressed as a stress related to a person's hereditary medical weakness. Individual breakdown usually occurs at our weakest point. In this way, man-made radiation mimics natural radiation and causes the aging or breakdown processes to be accelerated. In simpler language, again, there is no safe dose of radiation. In answer to one of the senator's questions before, there is something called the Peckow effect, which translates into this. When there is a high release of radiation, different aspects of the radioactive molecules will collapse into each other and nullify each other. So looking in it long run, low-level, consistent releases of radiation have long-term effects on our environment and our health. I can only give you a glimpse of what this may mean in health costs. During the February 2006 Minnesota PUC public hearings on the Monticello dry cast storage issue, I gave verbal and written testimony on statistics in just one specific area of health, breast cancer. The cost of breast cancer for this nation in 1997 was estimated to be greater than $2.5 billion. According to the Minnesota Cancer Facts and Figures 2003, which is available on the Minnesota Department of Health website, from 1996 to 2000, more than 3,400 women were diagnosed with invasive breast cancer each year within the state of Minnesota. Conservatively assigning that the treatment for this disease runs a course of 10 years, we presently have approximately 34,000 women struggling with the thought of losing a breast, recurrence, or potential death from breast cancer in this state alone. The incidence rate for female breast cancer in Minnesota in 2000 was 143.5 new cases per 100,000 women. Breast cancer has become the second leading cause of cancer death for women and accounts for 17% of all female cancer deaths. The mortality rate for breast cancer in Minnesota in 2000 was 26.9 deaths per 100,000 women. Now note, the Minnesota Department of Health states the cause of breast cancer can only be explained in 30 to 50% of all cases. I ask the question, are routine radioactive releases from Minnesota's nuclear power plants an underlying factor for the unexplained 30 to 50% taking into consideration that routine, low-level doses of radiation cause cell damage, often the beginning of cancer growth? One study done through the Minnesota Department of Health was completed and summarized in March 1995 as a report to the Minnesota legislative session that year. It was titled, Breast Cancer Mortality Rates and Trends Around Nuclear Power Plants in Minnesota. The study was done to refute the findings of Jay Gould and Ernest Sternglass, summarized in their book, The Enemy Within. The Minnesota study found a 14% increase in breast cancer in the counties surrounding the Monticello and Prairie Island nuclear power plant. Jay Gould's findings indicate a rise of 36%. Who are we to believe? Does it really make any difference? Either way, we are seeing a rise in breast cancer in counties where nuclear power plants are operating. Bottom line, that 14 to 36% increase translates into individual suffering and sometimes death. How do you put a cost on that? I found a study in the Annals of Oncology titled Long-Term Medical Cost of Postmenopausal Breast Cancer Therapy, copyrighted in 2006. Although costs may change for younger women with breast cancer, this article begins to give us a picture of cost. The study looked at the 10-year cost of treating single breast cancer cases in postmenopausal women with varying stages of breast cancer. Note these costs do not include out-of-pocket expenses, time away from work from the patient or family members, time lost from daily household activities, funeral expenses, loss of family income, or higher insurance premiums. The study concluded the cumulative 10-year cost per patient was equal to a mean average of approximately $38,000. For details, I would refer you to the testimony I gave at the Minnesota PUC hearing. Using the cost figures from the Annals of Oncology study and using the Minnesota Department of Health's findings of a 14% increase in breast cancer in counties nearest to nuclear power plant, the findings for Wright County alone are as follows. There were 108 incidences of female breast cancer newly diagnosed in 1999, one out of 274 women in Wright County. There were 29 incidences of female breast cancer deaths in 1999, one out of 1,022 women in Wright County. 14% of 108 leaves us with approximately 15 women in Wright County who will develop breast cancer due to routine radiation releases each year. Now, this is according to the Minnesota study. The mean average for breast cancer treatment, again, is 38,000. 38,000 times 15 cases of breast cancer leaves a cost of approximately $570,000 each year by 15 families within Wright County because of the operation of a nuclear power plant. Although population continues to change in the region, using 1999's population as a set point, that $570,000 times 40 years of nuclear power plant operation leaves a cost of approximately $23 million incurred by the families living in Wright County. Adding another 20 years of nuclear operation, the families of Wright County are incurring an additional $11 million in cost. If the Minnesota Department of Health was wrong and the study done by Jay Gould was right, double the cost. Note that these figures concern roughly only one-third of the population of Wright County and target only women. There are nine other counties in Minnesota near the Monticello and Prairie Island nuclear power plant, including four other counties across the river in Wisconsin. I addressed only one health risk. We, as a state, need to do research on the other health risks and costs being caused by our continued use of nuclear power. We need to uncover this hidden truth and add it to the final bill in estimating the true value of nuclear power. Thank you.
Dr. Rother, do you know what the national statistic for breast cancer is?
I would have to go back up and look it up.
I believe it's 1 in 8 women.
I believe it, and it's growing, yes.
Yes. Have you done any research on the health risks to nuclear power plant workers?
No, I have not. You have to understand I run in my own business, and I'm doing this research on the side.
Okay. Thank you.
I have to point out with that, Madam Chair, that the state has the means to find out this information, and we haven't.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Michaud. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I do have a one-page handout for the committee. My name is Mike Michaud. I am an energy consultant, and my background is in electrical engineering, wind energy, and public policy. And I'm here because I gave testimony in the PUC proceeding on Monticello in regard to generation alternatives. So I'm going to talk about the electrical side of the equation regarding nuclear power, and in particular the Monticello plant. The one-page paper I'm handing out to you is a summary of an alternative to the Monticello facility, and most of the information on this page is excerpted from the record. If you ever have time to read one of those things, they're very boring kinds of documents, but they're full of information. And I'm here to report to you that a lot of the analysis, especially in regard to wind energy in that docket, was fatally flawed. There were improper assumptions used in the analysis, especially by the DOC, Department of Commerce, and Xcel Energy, relating to the ownership structure, the location, the size of wind energy projects. And then one of the major flaws was under projections of energy production and capacity factor. They did not use the modern turbines that we are installing today in their analysis. They used older style turbines with lower tower heights and lower energy productions. And another major flaw was two key factors that are significant regarding the economics of wind systems: the production tax credit and local economic developments from community ownership were not appropriately considered in their analysis. Having said that, the record contains some valuable information about the option of using community-based wind energy in conjunction with combined cycle natural gas plants. The various alternatives were analyzed, and the combination of natural gas facilities and wind could be available in the time frame that was needed to replace the plant. And it, with their flawed analysis, it showed up slightly higher cost. Some of the information in that record shows that accounting for the economic benefits of community ownership structure rather than utility ownership structure of the wind plants produced $193 million of savings. And the major impacts have come from accounting for the economic benefits from the federal production tax credit and the production increases that occur with the new modern-style turbines that can get up to 80 meters in height. Those two combined produced about $900 million of present value revenue requirement. Additionally, a factor that wasn't considered in the analysis is the fact that every renewable resource you put online to replace Monticello counts towards achieving the renewable energy standards that were just passed by this legislature. Now, summary from what we were able to introduce in the record is that once you account for those kinds of benefits, that the option of using gas and wind plants together actually produced a savings compared to the continued operation of the Monticello plant for an additional 20 years. And again, I have to remind you that what we're comparing here is the sunk costs of the plant are already there, and we were comparing the marginal costs of operating the plant against the capital costs of building all new facilities, which is a rather steep hurdle to overcome, and it appears that you can beat it even under those unfair comparisons. You heard earlier how a new plant might cost $4 billion, so if we were comparing new plants to new plants, the advantage to using gas and wind would even be greater. One thing I want to point out to you is that there's been some concern about using too much natural gas can drive up the price. And you should consider that natural gas is probably a bridge technology, bridge-type fuel. And too often we look at the future through a rearview mirror and we assume that we're only going to have the tools we had in the past to deal with the future energy needs. And I submit to you that if you take a look at some of the analyses that have been done by the National Academy of Engineering, it shows that wind and hydrogen storage can be a very cost-competitive energy source for baseload-type facilities in the future years. So in 10 years' time horizon, things are going to change to the point where we'll be looking at wind and hydrogen as a possible base source. And lastly, I just want to point out to you There's always arguments that there's a shortage of generation resources on the horizon. We must run these facilities in order to maintain reliability in the system. These do not hold up under scrutiny. Just to confirm where things are at with the MISO generation queue, I checked my numbers again yesterday. There are 14,000 megawatts of generation waiting to come online in the MISO queue just in Minnesota alone. Of that, 1,800 megawatts were combined cycle gas capacity, 6,774 megawatts of nameplate wind capacity are in the queue waiting to come online. And all of those facilities, except for 600 megawatts of wind, have proposed in-service dates before the end of the year 2010, the time when we could phase out Monticello. So in summary, there are alternatives to the Monticello plant that include renewable resources, and they can be done cost-effectively. So we shouldn't be considering that we don't have any options to continue an operation of that facility. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker is Kristen Ide Tollefson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Kristen Ide Tollefson, and I actually live 15 miles south of Prairie Island, just outside the 10-mile emergency planning zone in Florence Township, where I'm a planning commissioner. And in 1995 and 97 through 97, I served as chair of the regulatory subcommittee on the Environmental Quality Board Citizen Site Advisory Task Force for the Goodhue County dry cask storage, where we reviewed an application from Xcel, very much like the one that was submitted to for Monticello. I'm also a founding member of our local citizens group, CURE, and the mission we took on in 1995 was responsible nuclear waste management, which, as you all know, is a multi-generational task. And I've represented CURE in dozens of dockets before the Public Utilities Commission and try to keep very close tabs on the nuclear waste situation. I've actually spent several of my winter and summer vacations with the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition at Yucca Mountain and lobbying in Washington with Mr. Alders. So as you can see, I've been following these issues very closely. I'm not here today to advocate for closing the plant or any other outcome. I'm only here to urge you to support Senator Kubley's request that the legislature take the time it needs to review the implications of the public utilities decision. The opportunity for this review is guaranteed by statute, but as Mr. Fuller told you, by current law, this review must be completed, and any conditions or modifications that the legislature wishes to make to that decision must be done by end of 2007. Specifically, in 116C.83, the legislature said that it wanted to review alternatives, such as Mr. Michaud was discussing. It wanted to ensure that storage would comply with the terms of the state's Radioactive Waste Management Act, which at this point does not allow permanent storage in Minnesota, or at least reserves that decision for the legislature. And it also does not want storage for waste outside of Minnesota. Also to adhere that the storage conditions should adhere to water standards and protection of ground and source water protections. Specifically, I'm here to notify you that there is a very serious gap in the PUC decision record that raises all of the above concerns and also can create significant legal and fiscal exposure for the state. The state's economic and environmental well-being over the long term. That is that the PUC decision makes way for the condition that we would have long-term or permanent storage in casks and storage facilities that are designed for temporary storage. Xcel, of course, could not tell the PUC how long the waste would be at Monticello, and where its destination might be. And for some combination of reasons, the PUC record or decision itself did not address the permanency issue at all. This is very much outside the precedent in Minnesota's administrative proceedings. And despite the fact that there was extensive expert testimony and vigorous advocacy from Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and ME3 on this issue, the PUC also placed no conditions whatsoever on storage at Monticello. It's undisputed in the PUC record, as Senator Anderson has mentioned, that waste generated between 2010 and 2030, during the period of relicensing, will not be able to be emplaced in Yucca Mountain, and that the federal government has no other plan whatsoever for waste from the relicensed reactors. There are two claims that Xcel made in the record that are particularly disturbing to me, and that is the claim that the waste is someone else's responsibility, and that the record shows that Xcel has no plans for funding or maintaining or managing the waste at Monticello over the long term, or replacement of the facility should the casks deteriorate or the facility deteriorate. Now, the EIS was looking at a 200-year minimum storage at Monticello, and so that's a very significant period of time. And what is disturbing about these claims to me is that they don't match either the real situation or the findings of the record. In claiming that the waste is the federal government's responsibility, the utility ignores or does not convey the responsibility that it bears under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act that Senator Kubley mentioned on Tuesday, which states very clearly that the generators and owners of high-level radioactive waste and spent nuclear fuel have the primary responsibility to provide for and pay the costs of interim storage of such waste and spent fuel until such waste and spent fuel is accepted by the Secretary of Energy in accordance with the provisions of the Act. Xcel claims that the ISFACI and the CASCs, both designed and licensed, mind you, for temporary storage of nuclear waste, which is up to 40 years, will not require any maintenance or replacement for hundreds of years, but this is not what either the cask manufacturers or the government or the industry engineers say. According to testimony in the record from the cask manufacturers, the cask warranty is 20 years. The record also cites Yucca Mountain engineering studies and industry EPRI research estimating that without maintenance and management, casks and their concrete modules may begin to deteriorate and could release radiation into the biosphere within 60 to 100 years. That's not very long. And one of the four, in an extensive record developed on these issues, again, by these advocates, the expert witness of Dr. Thompson provided testimony on how the spent positive constructive testimony on how the spent fuel might be properly managed and maintained over the long term. But these recommendations, again, because of the constraints of the scope of the PUC decision, were entirely ignored by the commission. In fact, none of the recommendations of Dr. Thompson even appeared in the decision point options for the commission. So Dr. Thompson's conclusion is something that whether we discuss extending, ending, or expanding the role of nuclear in Minnesota, we should think about. He says, he advises that a credible strategy should be set forth for institutional, financial, legal, and physical arrangements that ensure ongoing containment and protection at our nuclear plants without relying on the Department of Energy or the federal government. The three greatest dangers that I see as a longtime advocate of responsible nuclear waste energy, is that the federal government will continue to allow waste to be generated at reactors for which it has absolutely no plan and which will not fit into Yucca Mountain. Second, that the waste will be left on site indefinitely or permanently in temporary storage facilities. This is actually the no-action alternative outlined in the Yucca Mountain EIS and a provision in recent congressional cap proposal. And finally, as Mr. Alders very adroitly assured us yesterday, the federal government and utilities would eventually exercise the take title provision of the Nuclear Waste Management Act. And as Mr. Alders' PowerPoint showed us, the waste would then be managed nationally, not locally. Now, this is a very subtle distinction. Notice that he did not say stored centrally, but managed nationally. And I think this is a very accurate reflection of the direction that the federal government is taking us. This could mean that the federal government would take title to the waste at the reactor sites, and unless Perhaps there were previous conditions and agreements. The state would no longer have any say or ability to see what waste is stored there, that the waste is funded, managed, or maintained adequately over the long term. I think we all know horror stories from federal sites. And actually, this was the worst-case scenario that our EQB task force identified, that the waste would simply be left on site. The federal government would take control, and we would, in essence, have federal storage sites within Minnesota boundaries.
Ms. Tollison, I'm going to ask you to wrap up in about 30 seconds.
Sure. The Minnesota ratepayers and taxpayers have no protection other than the exercise of the state's authorities. And at the very least, I believe that we must ask what additional funds or conditions would be needed to actually ensure responsible nuclear waste storage over the long term at the reactor sites. And second, who is responsible to provide for these measures, and how shall we, as a state, make for that provision? Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
Can I ask Ms. Idy Tollison a question?
Yeah.
Sorry. That's okay. She's being very prompt in ending. Madam Chair, Ms. Idy Tollison, I think you're absolutely right about the concern about the federal government taking title to this waste, and then what that would mean essentially is not that they're going to solve the problem, but that they're going to take away our power to have any control or any state's rights over the issue, but probably it would mean that it would stay cited here without any state legal authority at all. And that's what Senator Murphy's resolution that he just mentioned talks about, that, I think that's something that all of us probably can agree on, regardless of what our position is on the storage, and that's his resolution calls on Congress not to do that to us as states, to take away our authority to regulate this in whatever limited way that we have now, and to take title of it, because that's why I think Senator Murphy agrees with that, and I agree with that, and we both signed on to that resolution, and Senator Prettner-Solin did as well, and I think that is a very real fear and concern. I just wanted to ask one question, and that is, we talk a lot about ratepayers, but one thing that occurred to me after Senator Koch was speaking, occurred to me later, is that we know that there's a tremendous cost to ratepayers to the process that Xcel has gone through.
Oh, yes.
To try to find a solution to the waste storage has been incredibly costly to all of us as ratepayers, as well as to taxpayers. And I wonder if you know what the price of, if you have any idea what those dollar amounts are that have been spent in the effort to try to find a storage solution.
Madam Chair, Ms. Senator Anderson, yes. The nuclear waste, as closely as I can recall, Minnesota has paid into the Nuclear Waste Storage Fund, I think close to $500 million. And in addition, as you point out, there have been, the innumerable valiant attempts of Xcel to resolve this, including the Private Fuel Storage Initiative. The utility is presently in litigation with the Department of Energy, or with the federal government, and they're claiming millions of dollars of expenses that they need reimbursement, they should have a reimbursement on, that have been the effect of the delay of the federal storage. Now, they're including a very wide range of things that it might be very interesting for this committee to understand what the costs have been, because that information is extremely difficult to discover without a rate case and a very specific examination. As I recall, they are even, I heard that they were including some of the costs of the mandates, compensation that they had paid, and lobbying, of course, expenses are also paid by ratepayers, both at the federal and state level. So this is, Senator Anderson is right, is a very considerable amount of money, and it would be a very interesting piece of information to know. I don't know if it's in the legal record or not. It might be.
Well, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
And I don't think you mentioned the cost of building and trying to open Yucca Mountain is, maybe you mentioned that, but billions and billions and billions of dollars of taxpayer money.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I must say that this state actually established the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition, which is the one active organization that lobbies to fund Yucca Mountain and get the waste there. So I'm sort of unusual as an environmentalist in supporting that.
Thank you. Next speaker is Mr. Crocker. Mr. Crocker, I'm hoping you can hold your comments to about 3 to no more than 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do intend to be very brief. First of all, I would like to say that there has been this discussion of reprocessing and recycling nuclear waste, and I would urge the committee to understand. My name is George Crocker. I'm the executive director of the North American Water Office. Sorry for that. There is a difference between reprocessing and recycling. Reprocessing is a practice in which you grind up the irradiated fuel, you dissolve it in a witch's brew of chemicals, and then through a variety of chemical and physical processes, you extract the fissile fractions from that very caustic solution, leaving a witch's brew of very, very hazardous waste, irradiated radioactive material that is then vitrified. And perhaps some of you remember the incredible mobilization of paramilitary forces in Germany as they attempted to move vitrified waste that had been processed at La Hague back from France to Germany at Gorleben, where it was to find its so-called permanent resting place. So just because we reprocess doesn't mean anything in terms of our actual solution to the nuclear waste problem. Reprocessing does not solve anything in terms of nuclear waste. It just adds another waste stream and makes it much more caustic and chemically hazardous as well. I'd also like to say, in response to Senator Dahl's question about medical exposure and things of that sort, there is a real difference between natural background radiation, medical exposures, and the type of exposures that happen when it's ingested and inhaled, and then those radionuclides are incorporated into the body. That is the long-term, low-level exposure that Dr. Rother was talking about, and it is very different from the very short-term medical exposures that we have, where we gain knowledge, we do it purposefully, and then the radiation exposure is done, and the body has a chance to heal. So just the percentages of radiation exposure isn't the critical question. The critical question is how long are specific tissues exposed to that pulsing energy source. So therein is a significant difference. But I would like to say to this committee that it's not just the waste, contrary to what Senator Murphy said. It isn't just the waste. There's a variety of other issues. When we talk about the long-term low-level exposures, when we talk about the very real and mounting potential for catastrophic failure of reactor parts, just because they're getting old, the brittleization that happens, the metallurgists don't understand all of the mechanisms, nor is it possible to monitor every single component that needs to be monitored as we move forward in time as metals age and brittleize. I was involved with the relicensing procedure, and it was my intervention that actually allowed the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to identify a whole new category of parts that were outside their aging management routine that need to be managed, and it had to do with the plates that pumps were mounted on. They weren't looking at them. What would happen if the plate mounting were to break on a pump? You're maintaining the pump. That's all good. But what happens if its mounting bolt breaks and it's non-functional? Well, because we intervened just a couple years ago in the relicensing of Monticello, we're now looking at that particular eventuality. How many more are there? We don't know. It is not possible to physically monitor everything that needs to be monitored in order to ensure that you will not have a critical component malfunction over the next 20 years. And if it does, why, we just have created a sacrifice zone. We will be gone. That is a very, very real potential. You know, we can talk about the insurance involved with doing vaccinations for bird flu, but here we're creating, we're actually endorsing a threat, a mounting threat, that could literally turn vast portions of Minnesota into a sacrifice zone in which the survivors will leave and they won't come back. And that includes Minneapolis and St. Paul. And that's not just from failing reactor components. We're busy poking people all over the world And so we get into a security issue. The pool up there is 70 feet in the air. Is that troubling to anyone? The security is based on the premise that it won't be attacked because it's so robust. That is the dominant security strategy at Monticello, that it won't be attacked. But it could be attacked, and it could be attacked with weapons that anybody can procure if they're intent on extracting that kind of damage. And the weapons that they would use, you can see them on TV, they're shoulder mounted rockets, they have depleted uranium warheads that can burn through 3 feet of tank armor. The pool is next to exposed exterior walls. You can poke a hole in it from 4 miles off, so it doesn't matter if you have an armed guard. Doesn't matter. They could be counties away and send it in with a joystick. So these are the kinds of threats and risks that we're encouraging in our state, that we're willing to live with. Well, I think that we ought to have a much more robust discussion than we've had so far, Senator. I very, very much appreciate the opportunity to have had the discussion we have had. We think we've brought value for it, and we would very much encourage this ongoing discussion as the task force deliberates on these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next speaker, Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Mr. Crocker, just a question on the release of the radiation and at the plants. How often do they do that?
Mr. Crocker.
Tritium is released out the stack on a pretty much routine basis as it needs to be, as it's generated and produced in the course of the production of electricity. So that vent, as you see as you drive by on Highway I-94 going up to St. Cloud, at the top of that stack, virtually all of the time there is some amount of tritium going out of that. When we explode uranium atoms to make the heat, to generate the steam, to spin the turbine, to make the electricity, why we are making, if you remember your physics, the periodic chart, you're making every single one of those elements and all of their sons and daughters radioactively. Most of them are in two major chunks. But there's also liquids and gases that are created when you're blowing up those uranium atoms. The gases are stripped off, and they are stored in the storage tank that Ms. Fouché talked about. And then they are held in that tank for a period of time. But you know, when you are putting gases continually into an enclosed area, the pressure builds. And as you build that pressure, one of two things happen if you continue to put gas in. Either the container explodes because the pressure is too great, or you release it. If you continue to put gas into an enclosed area, that's what you have. Those are your choices. And so as we explode those uranium atoms, you are constantly making these radioactive sons and daughters, some of which are gaseous. You put them in the tank. They hold them for a designated period of time. They wait for the right, at that time, meteorological phenomenon, and then out they go. And we don't know they go from there.
Yeah. Senator Dahl.
Is that just on a daily basis, a weekly basis?
That would be the release of the tank is on a periodic basis. Okay. That is not on a daily basis.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Crocker. The next speaker is Ron Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ron Johnson. I am here to testify today on behalf of the Pearl Island Indian community. I'm in my second consecutive term as an elected member of the Pearl Island Tribal Council, which is our community's governing body. My community has strong interest in the state policies regarding nuclear power and nuclear waste storage, and I thank you for holding this informational hearing and for the opportunity to testify today. Nearly 35 years ago, my community became a site for a nuclear power plant. Years later, in 1994, this legislator also authorized a nuclear waste storage site at Prairie Island. These facilities were sited near our community very much against our will. Today, Prairie Island is the closest community in the United States located to a nuclear power plant and a nuclear waste storage site. Twin nuclear reactors and nearly two dozen nuclear waste storage now just sit 600 yards from our homes. There's only one evacuation route off our island, and this is a pathway that is frequently blocked by passing trains. Our community never wanted a nuclear neighbor. These facilities were located near us largely because we lacked the resources to stop it. In the years since, we have learned to coexist with the plant. We participate in emergency training and exercises. We also employ our own environmental protection and emergency planning staff. However, even with these precautions, the plant remains a major source of distress for our community. Most concerning to us is the nuclear waste that gathers just beyond our reservation border and the lack of commitment policymakers have shown to solving the nation's nuclear waste problem. Our tribe is among hundreds of communities in this country in 39 states that currently live near what's supposed to be temporary nuclear waste storage sites, and there are now 22 storage casks at Prairie Island. Dozens more will be added in the coming years. Monticello will soon serve as the state's second nuclear waste site. Congress first set out to solve the nation's nuclear waste problem in 1982 when it passed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. Since then, with the exception of passing the resolution affirming Yucca Mountain as a national repository, Congress has passed no meaningful legislation to deal with this waste problem. Despite billions of dollars, with a B, paid to the National Nuclear Waste Fund, including more than $600 million from Minnesota ratepayers, Congress routinely underfunds the radioactive waste program. There's also alarming legislation currently before Congress that would require the federal government to take title of the nation's nuclear waste and keep it at places like Prairie Island and Monticello. Until the storage problem is solved, we believe it is irresponsible to consider building new nuclear power plants anywhere in this country, especially in Minnesota. We also are troubled by the lack of local involvement in advancing a storage solution for the nation's nuclear waste. Our state is not doing enough. Last year, the Department of Energy proposed sweeping reforms to the National Radioactive Waste Program that would help federal government speed up the process of opening Yucca Mountain. This major policy initiative did not warrant a single mention in either the Star Tribune or the Pioneer Press. Not one local official spoke out publicly in support of this proposal. Understandably, for many people in this issue, it is out of sight, out of mind. We don't have the luxury at Prairie Island. Every time we look out our living room windows, we are reminded of our nation's failing nuclear waste policy. There may be no perfect solution to this nuclear waste storage problem, but we believe Yucca Mountain is far the most reasonable solution. The Yucca Mountain facility is located many miles from civilians. It is below ground, militarily secure, and designed for permanent storage. It is simply a better alternative than leaving nuclear waste where it currently sits, in some cases, just yards from a vulnerable community like ours. From a standpoint of national security, it seems logical that defending one nuclear waste site is better than defending many. On behalf of our community and the Tribal Council, I urge you to resist looking to nuclear power as a future energy source until this nation gets serious about solving its nuclear waste problem. I also respectfully that you support Senate File 2237, which is a resolution urging Congress to fully fund the radioactive waste program, opposing efforts, and result in highly radioactive nuclear waste being left in our state forever. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Thank Johnson. You. Next speaker is Mike Franklin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Energy Policy Director for the 2,400 members of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Minnesota Chamber of Commerce supports eliminating Minnesota's ban on certificates of need for new nuclear generation, as you've seen in legislation today proposed by Senators Murphy and Jungbauer. We do so for several reasons. Chief among our reasons is to give the Public Utilities Commission all of its options. We ask the question, why limit the state's options by banning one technology from competing with others to meet customers' needs? We've heard a lot of evidence today of the ample record that the PUC builds in these matters, and as Senator Murphy said, they are the experts. All proposals for new generation, whether generated by natural gas, coal, wind, hydropower, IGCC, or nuclear, should be weighed against the requirements of Minnesota law and approved, rejected, or modified by the PUC. keeping all of our options open will help keep Minnesota's reliability and rates competitive. Adding new reliable baseload electricity is critical to keeping Minnesota's status as a low-cost, high-quality state for electric customers. This distinction helps keep energy-intensive companies in Minnesota and will help to recruit more companies that depend on quality, competitively priced power to our state. As you heard on Tuesday, Xcel Energy's current nuclear fleet is among the most cost-effective generation in their system. While the economics of any new generation are certain to be different from existing generation, the demands of a carbon-constrained economy may change that dynamic, and all options need to be on the table. In order to provide reliable, competitively priced baseload for the next generation of Minnesotans, the legislature has the opportunity to start the process by allowing the PUC to consider new nuclear generation as one way to meet customers' needs. Any proposed nuclear energy facility will endure similar and, in some cases, greater scrutiny as other proposed facilities at the PUC. We support Senate File 2081, Senate File 1930, Senate File 1491, and Senate File 1608 as ways to ensure that the PUC has all its options on the table as it considers how to meet Minnesota's energy needs. Thank you, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Next speaker is Jim Alders.
Madam Chair, thank you. Jim Alders from Xcel Energy. I guess I wanted to briefly make three points. That in terms of process, all of the issues you've heard today are very serious matters that deserve a great deal of time and attention to examine. And processes and institutions have been put in place to examine each and every one of those issues in considerable depth over decades of time. We, the federal government, numerous institutions take all of those issues extremely seriously and have examined them in great deal of depth. And all of the issues that you heard today have been brought before. We think that the process that was put in place in 2003 to examine whether or not the Monticello nuclear power plant should continue to operate was a wise one. In that process, you delegated fact-finding to the Public Utility Commission, and they in turn delegated that fact-finding to an administrative law judge. All the parties that spoke presented similar argument to that hearing examiner. There were something like 7,000-plus pages of testimony. There were numerous public exhibits. All of that resulted in a report from the hearing examiner that laid out 200 and some findings. I understand that you've now got a copy of that. Each and every one of the issues that you heard today were addressed. And indeed, the hearing examiner disagreed with a lot of what you heard today. Public Utility Commission then took all of that, heard similar arguments to what you did today in oral arguments before they made their decision. And again, Public Utility Commission took all of the evidence that was presented and said, on balance, we think the best thing to do is to continue to operate the nuclear power plant at Monticello. And in order to do that, they granted the 30 storage containers that are necessary to keep the plant running if the feds don't show. All of these issues are issues that need a great deal of depth and examination. And I think we all would have to agree that we're only going to scratch the surface in legislative hearings. And indeed, when you go to an administrative law judge and present all of that evidence, he has to sort through all of it. And he has to weigh both the claims of health effects or the claims of that Yucca Mountain will never show against the other evidence that indeed there is progress being made, albeit not as fast as we all would like. And indeed there are balances and countervailing opinions to some of the issues that have been presenting concerning health effects. And on balance, they concluded that it's in Minnesota's best interest to continue to use nuclear power. The next point I wanted to make has to do with some of the bills that have been put on the table concerning taking more time. Extend the stay of the Public Utility Commission decision to grant a certificate of need. Extend that stay by a year. There are real consequences to doing that. And that's the one-page handout I wanted asked to have put before you. We are poised to make a number of investments at the Monticello and Prairie Island nuclear power plants to provide spent fuel storage, to invest so that those facilities can increase their production, and to make ongoing investments at those power plants so that they can safely operate well into the future. The bar chart on the first side of that is the complex schedule that's been laid out to accomplish all of those things over time, and I won't go over that in detail. The backside tries to summarize what the real consequences of a delay are. Right now, the plan is to begin construction of this dry storage facility at Monticello immediately after this session is completed, assuming that the stay is lifted and the certificate of need decision by the PUC remains. If there is a one-year stay, then we do not have a certificate of need and we cannot start construction. Thus, construction will be delayed, and as the result, we will be forced to make modifications to the existing pool inside the power plant so that additional storage could be accommodated in that pool so that the plant can continue to operate to 2010, and the cost of doing that is $2 to $3 million. As I mentioned, we're also poised to make filings seeking approval to increase the production at the plants. We plan to make a filing for Monticello later on this summer. We plan to make a filing for Prairie Island asking for a certificate of need from the Public Utility Commission to do that this fall. If there's a stay, the future of nuclear power in Minnesota is uncertain, and it seems to us that we can't make those filings with that uncertainty about what this body's view on nuclear power really is. And thus, we feel that we would have to delay those filings, and that would cause us to have to delay the implementation of those increases, assuming they were approved by the Public Utility Commission. And that would cause us to have to purchase replacement power instead of taking advantage of the power that could be produced from our nuclear power plants. There's a real cost associated with those delays and those replacement power requirements, etc. Do I know exactly how much it is today? No, I don't. But it's in the tens of millions, I'm quite confident. Similarly, we have a long-term investment program in place to invest in equipment at the power plants that will allow us to operate those facilities efficiently and safely beyond their current license life. Big example of that is this large steam generator apparatus at Prairie Island. We have plans to replace a steam generator at the power plant in the coming years so that the facility can continue to operate safely and efficiently. But we don't need to make that investment if the plant's going to shut down in 2013 or 14. And so that calls into question whether or not we should continue to plan and contract for that $260 million investment in that power plant. And indeed, the process of contracting for those large pieces of equipment, engineering, exactly how the work's going to be done at the power plant, et cetera, is a very complex sequence of events. And even though we don't plan on doing the actual work until 2013 or so, everything cascades if we have a delay. And indeed, we currently are in line with the fabricators and working with them to develop contracts and do engineering. If we have to delay, our place in line becomes called into question. Now, could we work something out after a year's delay? Perhaps. But there's increased risk that we might lose our spot in line. All of those delays, again, have consequences, and I don't know exactly how much it would translate in dollars, but it is tens of dollars if you own tens of millions of dollars. If you only start thinking about inflation rates on 2 years of delay when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. There are real consequences to delay. We don't think that there's anything to be learned that hasn't already been examined in great deal of detail. We think that the framework that was established got it right, and that the fundamental policy questions are what this is about for you, not the details of and the important matters of health and safety and alternatives, et cetera. You aren't going to learn a whole lot more in another year about those kinds of questions that haven't already been examined in depth. I would really encourage you to skim through the findings of fact that were presented by the administrative law judge and that were adopted by the Public Utility Commission, covering each and every one of the subjects you heard today. Madam Chair.
Mr. Alders, in the event that Monticello were going to close, could you leave those casks in the pool, or would they have to be moved anyways to dry cask storage?
Madam Chair, in order to decommission the power plant, we've got to take the spent fuel in the pool and remove it from that pool before we can decommission it. And so we would indeed be back to the Public Utility Commission asking for permission to store 40 containers of spent fuel at Monticello if the plant shut down in 2010.
Okay. Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Alders, we've heard a lot of, I guess, maybe contradictory statements about whether Yucca Mountain can actually store all the spent waste that's been in this country or generated to this point. I guess, so I have a two-part question. Number one, can it store all the nuclear waste? And the second part is, in what form is it stored? If it comes in a cast, do they leave it in the cast, or do they take the rods out? I'm curious about that.
Mr. Alders.
Senator Olsen, the Nuclear Waste Policy Act establishes an administrative limit of 70,000 metric tons uranium as the limit for how much spent nuclear fuel can go to Yucca Mountain. The environmental impact statement that was done by the Department of Energy, the site suitability report that was done by the Department of Energy and other federal agencies all point out that the physical capacity of Yucca Mountain is two or three times that. You know, it's kind of like building a 1,000-car parking lot, passing a law that says you can only use 400 spaces in that parking lot. What's the capacity of the parking lot? Is it 1,000 cars or is it 400 cars? I have no doubt that if indeed Yucca Mountain is established and starts operating, that there will be serious consideration to changing that administrative limit. It's only in the nation's best interest to maximize the utilization of whatever storage capacity it has. The
the way in which spent fuel is to be stored at Yucca Mountain is that the containers that we've shown you at Monticello will be placed in a transportation overpack, put on a rail car, sent to Yucca Mountain, where there will be a receiving facility. And in that receiving facility, the container we've proposed will be taken out of their transportation overpack, and one of two things will happen. They'll either open up the container and take the spent fuel and put it into a Yucca Mountain container, or they will take our spent fuel container, put it into a disposal overpack, and then move that disposal overpack into the mountain. Okay? The other thing everyone should keep in mind is the Nuclear Waste Policy Act provides that Yucca Mountain will remain open for at least 50 years after it starts operating, and as long as 300 years after it starts operating. So it's not a matter of taking the stuff to Yucca Mountain and throwing away the key immediately. It's a matter of consolidating all that spent fuel that's currently in 39 states around the nation, consolidating in one location at Yucca Mountain. And if it's in the nation's best interest to reprocess or in some other way utilize that spent fuel, we've got up to three centuries to do that. This is not a take it there and throw away the key kind of operation that's being proposed.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to spend a lot of time, but having toured Yucca Mountain just last year along with Senator Senjum, Senator Dibble, and a number of other senators who were there last year, I think one thing we heard is that, you know, one of the flaws with that idea of being able to go back into the mountain is that I think once all the waste is in there, it won't be possible for anyone to go anywhere near inside that mountain. But I'm just trying to remember the details of what they said about that. The other thing I would just mention is that remember what Senator Kubley said, that in Nevada, all the elected officials are so dead set against this. And I heard that there was talk again in Washington of reopening a national search for a repository. Now, that's maybe coming from Senator Reid. I wouldn't be surprised if he would be leading the charge, because he's been fighting the storage in his own site, in his own state. But keep in mind that the original search for a site included Minnesota as one of its top three sites at one point in time before they narrowed the search to Yucca Mountain. And so watch out what we wish for. It's all I would say, that if that were to happen, we certainly don't want to be looked at as a national repository site for nuclear waste in Minnesota. Madam Chair, I'm sorry, this isn't a question, but I think we're probably running out of time, so I just want to thank you for having this hearing. I think it really is an important issue for us to be familiar with in this committee, so thank you for taking the time to do it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Alders. I don't know what committee members want to do, and we're not prepared to vote on anything today, but you might think about, you know, where you want to go if any of these alternatives is something that we just needed to have a hearing on, or whether any action is necessary on any of them at this time. There are consequences to all of them, obviously. And I think that perhaps we need to have more hearings than we've had currently. It's a good beginning discussion and something that we'll want to continue in years to come. Next week, we start on telecom, and we will have a meeting on Tuesday to hear about several telecom bills. We will not be voting on the bills again. They're very controversial. We have a lot to learn about telecommunications, and so we will begin by having just a brief history and an overview of telecom issues and a presentation of the bills, and then I'm going to ask the members who are introducing the bills to please hold stakeholder meetings over the interim on the bills. So any further questions? Meeting is adjourned then.